It's day four in the trial of Zahar Tsarnaev, the now admitted perpetrator of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings, which killed three and injured more than 260. Last week, in opening statements, the defense acknowledged, yes, their client did it, along with his older, now deceased brother, Tamerlan. This week, we're seeing the two brothers together for the first time in this trial. This is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen with the Boston Globe.
Kevin, in day three of testimony, this trial took a turn. We have been hearing from a steady parade of the victims, mesmerizing stories from the victims. Now we've turned to physical evidence, hard evidence. And what is striking about day three and somewhat into day four is, I think, perhaps one of the most modern trials, or what's become the most modern trial in Boston's history. The fact that through the ubiquity of surveillance cameras, the FBI was able to put together a 9-minute video showing the two brothers walking together, coming onto Boylston Street, the main boulevard in the Boston Marathon and the finish line, and we actually saw them over the course of 9 minutes from corner to corner to corner. One of them stops in front of the Forum restaurant. The older brother, Tamerlan, continues another block or so to the finish line and across from the reviewing stand. And we see what happens. We see the backpacks. We can see something comes off Zahar's shoulder. He's putting it down. We assume that's the backpack. And then we hear the explosions right where the backpack went down. This is devastating evidence.
Years ago, it would have been portrayed as something Orwellian. And in this case, it's being used to prosecute the people who carried this attack out. And I thought, for all the remarkable 9-minute video they were able to compile that showed the paths of the brothers, if I'm a juror and I'm sitting there, the thing that would have struck me and would have stuck with me is the security camera from the Whole Foods store in Cambridge, where less than a half an hour after these two brothers carried out these horrific attacks, we see Zahar Tsarnaev enter the Whole Foods store, go in, and after some deliberation, pick out a half a gallon of milk. He leaves the store and then decides, well, I don't have the right kind of milk. So he goes back in and exchanges the milk. So less than a half an hour after leaving that death and destruction in his wake, he's out there just, what kind of milk do I want? That, if I'm a juror, is the image that stays with me.
And this is a perfect illustration of what I've been thinking. We're told that this is a trial with two phases. The guilt phase, the first phase, or the liability phase, and the second being the sentencing phase, in which you can talk about aggravating factors and mitigating factors. But what you've talked about goes right to the heart of the issue here. There is no one phase separate from the other. The fact that Zahar is buying milk in a store does not connect. Perhaps it puts him at a certain point of his day. It doesn't connect to the crime itself. If you had Joe Friday, who was doing interrogation, you could hear him say, just the facts, ma'am. It doesn't go to the just the facts, ma'am part of this. However, it has this devastating effect. I thought when Jessica Krensky, the victim, testified on day three, and she loses two legs. Eventually, she loses two legs. Her husband loses one leg. A harrowing story. Mm. The jurors love every one of these witnesses. Our humanity draws us to them. They're attractive people who showed selflessness and just heartbreaking stories. They ask her, Jessica Krensky, to circle her husband in one of the photographs, and she puts a heart instead of a circle. It goes to the nature of this. It's all part of that story, and it's all part of aggravating factors that are supposed to be left to the end.
The thing that struck me about Jess Krensky when she entered the court, David, is that, as you've seen, Zahar Tsarnaev has built this sort of screen around him in which he has not paid much attention to people coming and going, particularly to the people he is, his own lawyers admit he caused such horrible suffering in Case's death. And yet, when Jess Krensky came in, pushed in a wheelchair, trailed by her rescue dog, a black lab named Rescue, all of that, having to be pushed up on a ramp to be able to get into the witness stand, Even Jahar Tsarnaev's eyes involuntarily, unconsciously drifted to her and lingered on her. I think she was one of the most effective witnesses we have seen so far.
And yet the defense has somewhere to go, perhaps because they can't go anywhere else, but they've interviewed their first witness now. And that occurred on day three when they're talking about, the FBI agents and others were talking about that whole video sequence. And the defense was able to establish that in that video, never once do you see Jahar leading the way. He's always behind his brother. And so what they establish here is one is following the other. That's what they've wanted to do. That, too, goes to mitigating circumstances that they'd like to bring in here. And I think it reminds me, Kevin, that doubt is the enemy of certainty, and that's what they're working with, doubt amongst the jurors. If they can establish that, they will have saved him from the death penalty.
Well, that's video evidence of the defense narrative. The defense couldn't – it's interesting. If you recall, there was this to and froing in which an agent, an FBI agent, suggested there were other parts in the video in which they were walking side by side, and even there were cases in which Jahar took the lead. But that wasn't obvious. It wasn't demonstrative in the film. The only thing, the image that will last with the jurors is that one of Tamerlan clearly leading the way down Boylston Street. And as an old ink-stained wretch, it's hard for me to admit this, but images are much more powerful than words in a case like that.
And the defense attorney who established that, Miriam Conrad, a ferocious cross-examiner who has shredded FBI agents in the past on the stand. I've seen it well. And we saw her do that today with Jahar's Twitter accounts.
The government was trying to show that the tweets on Jahar's account suggested the sort of the language that would be used by a jihadi, would be used by somebody inculcated in radical Islam. And yet, very quickly, Miriam Conrad was able to establish that these tweets were references to rap lyrics, both Russian songs and American songs. She asked the agent, did you do any research of some of these lyrics, of these quotes? And he did acknowledge that he knew one of them referred to Eminem. She asked him if he knew what "The Block Is Hot" meant. He said no. She said it was from Lil Wayne, a rapper. She asked him, do you know what "New York State of Mind" referred to? He said no. It was from a rapper named Nas. I must say, I'd give him this much credit. At least he didn't say it was from Billy Joel.
And your point here is that what they're trying to do is say that he's just another teenager on the internet, being foolish, irresponsible, obnoxious, that that's what he's doing, whereas they are portraying him as the jihadi. And they are assuming here the worst about him. And Conrad, Miriam Conrad, has the knife out with this agent. And she is able to establish, not only does he not know about the comedy sketch that was invoked in one of these tweets, but also that the picture that the agent said was of Mecca is not of Mecca. It is of Grozny, Chechnya, a mosque there instead.
Yeah. I thought Conrad, if she had to pick out the moment she would probably prefer to remember most, was when she was able to get Kimball to admit that the tweet was, "September 10th, baby, you know what tomorrow is, party at my house." Now, obviously, that would suggest somebody who is cruel, heartless, tasteless, you take your pick. But in fact, it came from, while Conrad didn't say it specifically, it comes from a show called Tosh.0, which is actually very popular with college kids who like to sit around their dorm rooms getting high. And that was exactly the image that the defense wants the jury to draw. Not some wannabe jihadi kneeling on a prayer mat looking up to a poster of Osama bin Laden, but some kid down at UMass Dartmouth sitting with his buds and a bowl watching Tosh.0.
We've gotten somewhat excited about a cross-examination here because it's the only cross-examination we've witnessed, but it does go to a point the defense is trying to make.
Well, the point is, if the FBI can't get the little stuff right, if they can't, you know, Google lyrics and find out that they are rap songs, if they can't get the pictures of a mosque and tell the difference between Mecca and Grozny, The question is, if they can't get that stuff right, why should we trust them on the big stuff?
The fact that this is what has sort of excited us here indicates how difficult the defense's case is.
This is all the defense cares about, the why. They have already acknowledged the what, that what happened, the deaths, the destruction, the loss of limbs, the loss of so much else in this town. And they acknowledge that. It was him, they said. But this, the reason today was so significant, it was the first time the defense got anywhere near being able to put before the jury their version of the why Jahar Tsarnaev did this.
Day four ends with the judge and the lawyers on both sides looking at a boat, the boat that Jahar Tsarnaev was found in Watertown, Massachusetts. Penciled on its sides inside that boat is the so-called confession, or what the prosecution would say is the confession. That will be prominent in day five and day six. And that's it for day four in the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev. This is Finish Line inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. I'm David Borey from WBUR.
I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Join us again on Thursday.
Finish Line, Inside the Boston Marathon Bombing Trial, is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at bostonglobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.